Hi everyone. I guess that's a good enough cue to get started. Hi everyone. My name is Rebecca Winter. It's great to see you all on this January evening. I was given a message from Rabbi Kelman that he is driving to a simcha in New Jersey, so he's not going to be able to be here to moderate this session. So I'm going to be self-moderating. So please bear with me as I do that. And deal with some of the technical sides tonight. But hopefully everything will go smoothly and I'm going to try my very best here flying solo. So it's wonderful to see you all. And I'm very much looking forward to sharing with you and discussing with you some interesting things that I found in this week's Parsha and this week's Sedra, Parshat Bo, which occurs in the book of Exodus and Shemot. So I'm going to start off by sharing my screen with you. I think there were slides included, which you may have gotten, but I'll share them with you because we'll work through them all together. So just give me a second while I share my screen. All right. Hang on. Is everybody able to see that? Hang on. Sorry. Okay. Can everybody see that? Is that a bit better? All right. So this week, tonight, we are going to be talking about, as I said, Parshat Bo. And we're specifically going to be discussing Rosh Chodesh and the role of humans in creation through this lens of Parshat Bo tonight. And before we get started, I am a teacher. I live in Atlanta and I have the zchut, the tremendous honor of teaching in our local high school, Atlanta Jewish Academy. And many of the ideas that I present and that we discuss tonight are really a tribute to the conversations that I've had over the past couple of years with some of my students at AJA. So I wanted to give them a shout out and a hakarat hatov as we work through some of these. So this week's Parsha Bo, when we really think about Parsha Bo, I usually think first of the last three makot of the 10 makot of the 10 plagues that Hashem punishes Mitzrayim with. So last week in Parshat Va'era, we had the first seven, and Parshat Bo wraps up these makot with the last three. So Makat Arba, Choshech, darkness, and finally Makat Bechorah, the death of the firstborn child. And what's unique really about Parshat Bo is that kind of embedded or surrounding this makkah of Makat Bechorah, we have this list. Oops, there you go. We have this list of laws that we as a nation really get for the very first time as the Jewish people, as a nation, in all of Torah. So this is the first time that we as a nation are commanded by Hashem to do specific things. And they come about in our parsha. So it's a really unique aspect of our parsha, which kind of jumpstarts this type of narrative. And specifically, the laws that we get are Rosh Chodesh, Korban Pesach, Chag HaMatzot, which is specifically the mitzvah or the commandment to eat matzah, the mitzvah of tefillin, and the mitzvah of pidyon bechorot or pidyon haben, redeeming the firstborn child, which we can imagine is very strongly related to Makat Bechorah for obvious reasons. Tonight, I would like to focus on those first three. So the Rosh Chodesh, Korban Pesach, and Chag HaMatzot. I'd like to focus on those together and understand them within the context of Makat Bechorot and maybe what we can learn about this first iteration and this first telling and this first giving over of laws to Bnei Yisrael. Sorry, I'm still just figuring this out. All right. So we'll start off with Rosh Chodesh. And it says this is Perek Yud Bet, the 12th Perek of Shmot. And the very beginning of the Perek, Hashem says, "Vayomer Hashem el Moshe ve'el Aharon be'eretz Mitzrayim le'mor, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim Rishon Hu Lachem L'Chodshei Hashana. So Hashem says to Moshe and Aharon in Mitzrayim, this month shall mark for you the beginning of the months, and it will be the first of the months of the year for you. So this is the mitzvah of Bnei Yisrael getting Rosh Chodesh. And I'd like to explore two different approaches to this mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh. The first one is by Sforno, who is a biblical commentator from Italy, I believe. I'm an Italian commentator from the end of the 15th to the mid 16th century. And he says, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim, Mikan Va'elach Giyu HaChodashim Shelachem. From now on, these months are going to be for you. La'asot Bahem Kirtzonchem, to do with them what you want. Aval bimei hashiabud, but in the times of enslavement in Mitzrayim, lo hayu yameichem shelachem, your days were not your own. Aval hayu la'avodat acherim urtzonam, right? But they belonged really to other people, to your taskmasters, to the Mitzrayim. Lefichach rishon hu lachem l'chodshei hashana. Therefore, it says this will be the first month for you, the beginning of the year. Ki bo hitchil mitziutchem habchiri. This is where you're really starting off your free choice as a nation. What a beautiful explanation of the Sforno, who's really, I think, highlighting this word of lachem, for you. HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem. This is the first time this month really belongs to you. You are no longer slaves. So Sforno sees this this first ever mitzvah that we get as a nation as an emphasis on our freedom, that now we are no longer under the rule of the Mitzrayim, but this month now belongs to us. Our time is ours. You can imagine for kind of high school students how, you know, I teach 11th and 12th graders. This was very exciting for them to hear because they're envisioning their own freedom kind of coming at graduation. Lachem, our time will be ours. And that's the Sforno's understanding and his drush on these psukim. This Sforno really does get this. He's not just taking this from our Parsha, Parsha Bo, but in Parsha Pinchas, all the way in Bamidbar, Perakav Chet, it also says, Uvroshe Chod Shechem. And there Sforno also points out that whereas the other Chagim, it doesn't say they belong to us, for Rosh Chodesh, Roshe Chod Shechem, it is your month. So again, he points out the importance of Shelachem, it belongs to you. So just a nice involvement of the pshat by the Sforno. I'd like to now turn to another explanation. So we're going back in time a couple centuries, to the 13th century, the Ramban, who is, of course, a Spanish commentator and then later moved to Yerushalayim. And he has a very lengthy, lengthy commentary. I brought some of the Hebrew, but I'd like to read some of the English with you because it's a little bit dense to go through. But he has a very different perspective, in my view, on this idea of Rosh Chodesh. So here's the Hebrew for those of you who'd like to read it. It's longer even, several pages. And I brought some of the more salient aspects out for you. So what does he say? This month shall be unto you the beginning of the months. This is the first commandment which Hashem commanded Israel through Moshe. Therefore, it says in the land of Egypt. That's why it says specifically in Mitzrayim, it was commandment, because the rest of the commandments were given on Har Sinai. So he's explaining that this is a unique set of commandments because they're given to us in Mitzrayim. All right. According to the Midrashic interpretation, says the Ramban, and he quotes Masechet Rosh Hashanah, this process really of Rosh Chodesh involves witnesses who saw the appearance of the moon, and the process involved the witnesses who saw this appearance. This process is to be performed only by a court of experts, as Moshe and Aaron were. And this is the reason it does not say at the beginning, speak to all of Bnei Israel. Rather, it says, Daber al Moshe ve'Aharon. It says, speak to Moshe and Aharon, because this sanctification of Rosh Chodesh can only be performed by experts, so people of high caliber. So right away, the Ramban is taking a very different approach, where he's highlighting the very intricate and specific laws, which are really outlined in the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah, about Rosh Chodesh. And so he's pointing out really the intricacies behind this first law, HaChodesh HaZelachem. The Ramban continues, and he also wants to explain, what does it mean, this shall be to you the beginning of months, HaChodesh HaZelachem Rosh Chodeshim, is that Israel is to count this as the first of the months, and from there they count all the months. Why? In order that there be through this enumeration a remembrance of the great miracle of the Exodus from Egypt, which occurred in the first month. So the Ramban is really bringing two important aspects to Rosh Chodesh. First is the intricacies of the laws, and that they have to be performed by these high-ranking officials. And second, that the importance of Rosh Chodesh is to remember an important historic event, specifically Yetziat Mitzrayim. We could even say that the Ramban is highlighting the word Hazeh. What is important about HaChodesh Hazeh, this month? This is the month where we left Mitzrayim. Very much not highlighting the Lachem, but really Hazeh. This is the important month. And so if we think about really the differences between Sforno and Ramban, if we kind of dilute what they're saying into summarize, the Sforno says this month is there to do with what you like. And the Ramban says this month is there to mark a historic event and also to really give us these intricate laws of Rosh Chodesh. Now, in discussing this idea with my class, we always try to think about what is the nafkamina, or what is the important difference between two parshanim. What are they really arguing about? What's at the root of the difference in their opinion? And we came across Isaiah Berlin, who was a famous philosopher, I believe a Russian British philosopher, and he wrote in 1969 about. He famously distinguished between two basic concepts of freedom. Freedom from, or what he called negative freedom, and freedom to, or positive freedom. Freedom from, he says, consists in the absence of obstacles or constraints by one's own actions. By contrast, freedom to identifies the possibility to autonomously determine and achieve individual or collective purpose. And so Isaiah Berlin gives these two ideas of freedom, freedom from and freedom to. And when we look at the differences between Sforno and the Ramban, what we initially concluded in our class is that it seems like Sforno is more telling us about Rosh Chodesh as a freedom from aspect of Rosh Chodesh, that we are now free to do what we want, meaning we're free from the obstacles and constraints, from the shackles of Mitzrayim, whereas the Ramban is focusing more on that freedom too. That we are able to opt into, we have the freedom to opt into this set of laws, and he's really focusing on the intricacies of the laws that we can determine for ourselves. And so what we're always interested in also is, well, which opinion really bears out more in the pshat of the Chumash? And I'd like to explore that a little bit today with you. And so I have a few goals as we progress in this talk today. The first goal I have is to really better understand the Sforno's perspective, meaning the question is the Sforno really explaining or understanding the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh as a freedom from, that he sees this as you're free to do whatever you want, your days are totally yours, have at it? Or are we missing a nuance into what the Sforno is saying? I'd like to explore some of the structure of the laws of Pesach to give us some richness and understanding of Parsha Bo. And then I'd like to back channel and relate these laws back to Rosh Chodesh. So those are some of the goals that I have today. I'm just going to pause here because I see a couple questions in the chat, and this is a nice place to pause. Don't you have to have someone at the end row? Don't you have to have freedom from before you can have freedom to? Beautiful. That's a beautiful point. That first you have to kind of shake off the shackles. You have your days are free to you, and then the freedom to part comes. So they kind of come hand in hand. I love that idea. I don't know who said that, but that's a very beautiful idea. Yes, but I think what we were pointing out is that the nafgamina, or the difference between the sforno and the ramban, is which type of freedom each is highlighting, and not so much that both can't really work hand in hand, but rather that each see different aspects of Rosh Chodesh coming out in these different freedoms. That's a beautiful point. Okay, let's see. Some of these are lengthier questions. So if it's okay with you, I'll save some of them till the end, if that's okay. But that was a beautiful comment at the end over there. All right. What we're going to do is, this is a very, the laws are very lengthy, and Perek Yud Bet, the 12th Perek of Shemot, is actually 51 psukim long. So I wasn't able to give it to you through Sefaria or Machon Mamre to really, I really wanted to capture what the Perek looks like visually. So I took some screenshots of my own Koran Tanakh just to give us like a larger kind of global picture of what the Perek looks like. And the Perek really starts off, like I said, which is highlighted at the top. Excuse me. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe ve'el Aaron, that HaChodesh hazeh lachem Rosh Chodeshim. So that's kind of our title. That's the kotaret, the title of the perek. It starts off with HaChodesh hazeh lachem, the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh. And then the perek immediately following that goes into the lengthy laws of Korban Pesach for about 11 psukim, where Hashem describes to Moshe and Aaron when to take the seh, when to take the sacrifice, how and when to eat it. It continues over here, how you should eat it, and finally that it will, doing this mitzvah of Korban Pesach, will save you from Makah Bechorah. Hashem then transitions to talking about seemingly maybe a separate or different Chag HaMatzot. That's not the purpose of this shiur, to explain the difference between Korban Pesach or Chag HaMatzot, but it's an interesting nuance to these laws. He describes we get a new mitzvah, not of the Korban Pesach, but of eating the matzah, eating matzah, and a mitzvah not to eat chametz. After this, Moshe relays the mitzvah of the Korban Pesach to Bnei Israel with an emphasis on this as a preparation for Makah Bechorah, namely that following the laws of Korban Pesach is going to save them essentially from Makah Bechorah. This is an opt-in type of activity, an opt-in to being saved from Makah Bechorah. So again, taking the seh, using the blood on the doorpost to mark your homes, and the continuation of these preparations. So another lengthy description. The Perek then moves on to an actual detailed description of Makah Bechorah, killing of the firstborn Egyptians, passing over the houses of Bnei Israel. Then the Perek describes briefly how Bnei Israel left Mitzrayim. And finally, the Perek ends off strangely with a reiteration of the laws of Korban Pesach, where we learn about some of these intricacies of who specifically is or is not allowed to partake in the Korban Pesach and where you're supposed to be eating this Korban Pesach. So if you didn't follow that brief description, that's okay, because I have a nice summary for you here. So the Perek really can be divided into six parts. Remember, with Rosh Chodesh really being at the top. So starting off with the laws of Korban Pesach, followed by the laws of Chag HaMatzot, the preparation of the Korban Pesach for the purpose of being saved from Makah Bechorah, leaving Mitzrayim, and more specifics about the laws of Pesach. What's interesting about this Perek, and many modern day commentators point out about these laws specifically, is that they form what's called a chiastic structure or a parallel structure, as is described by Rav Yonatan Grossman. He has a beautiful series of shiurim on literary techniques used in the Tanakh. One of them is called chiastic structure. Chiasm essentially means that it's an A, B, C, C, B, A structure, meaning the outer two ideas of the Perek parallel each other. The inner two ideas of the Perek parallel each other, and then we're left with the middle idea or ideas, which also parallel each other and or are closely related, which forms this chiasm, this parallelism. There are two important things about chiastic structure, which it really teaches us about the Perek. One is that the chiastic structure kind of circles around one key point of the Perek, which for us is clearly the preparation of Makah B'Chorot and Makah B'Chorot itself. That really serves as the linchpin, the middle of the Perek. What's beautiful about this structure is that it becomes clear through this structure that Makah B'Chorot could not really have happened in the absence of the laws of Chag HaMatzot and Korban Pesach, meaning, again, emphasizing the importance of the actions of Bnei Yisrael in order for this Makah to happen, which is very unique among the Makot, where Bnei Yisrael were otherwise extremely passive in the other Makot. For Makah B'Chorot, we need this opt-in. We need it to be active in our participation. The second thing chiastic structure helps us with is understanding the message behind the pairings. So 3 and 4 are obviously related to each other. They both have to do with Makah B'Chorot. We are preparing for Makah B'Chorot through the Korban Pesach. And then number 4 gives us the reason why we were preparing, obviously, because if we hadn't prepared, we could have been part of Makah B'Chorot. So number 4 gives us the why for number 3. Similarly, we have number 2 and number 5, where we learn about the laws of eating matzah, but number 5 gives us the why. Why do we eat matzah? We eat matzah because lo yachlu lehit mameh. We were leaving Mitzrayim too quickly. And I brought the pasuk, vayafu et habatzek, and this is the pasuk from number 5. They were making the dough, asher hatsiu mi Mitzrayim, ugot matzah, ki lachametz, ki gorshu mi Mitzrayim, lo yachlu lehit mameh, vegam tzeda lo asu lahem, right? So they baked this matzah. And they were driven out of Mitzrayim. And so leaving Mitzrayim is explaining why we eat the matzah. Now, the obvious question comes about, why is it that we get the laws of matzah before leaving Mitzrayim if the reason we eat matzah is because we left Mitzrayim in a hurry? So it's an interesting question, and it really plays into the dual purpose of matzah, and different parshanim have different deliberations about it. It's a really great study, but not for this year. So I'm going to leave the question on the table, but you can see the parallelism of these two components. Leaving Mitzrayim explains why we eat matzah. And finally, that leaves us with numbers 1 and 6, where somehow the specifics of the laws of Korban Pesach give us the why for Korban Pesach, or kind of the purpose behind Korban Pesach. I want to show you some of the laws, the types of specific laws that we learn about in number 6. One of them is Biki Aguri Tchager Vasa Pesach. So if you have a stranger who's living with you and he makes Pesach, Himolo Kozachar, you have to make sure he's circumcised. Va'azi Krav La Sota, Vahayake Ezracha Aretz, V'chol Arel Lo Yachalbo, right? So you have to make sure he's circumcised. Anyone who's uncircumcised can't eat the Korban Pesach. So there's these intricacies to the laws, but it's unclear really how number 6 explains something about Korban Pesach. It seems like these are just minute or mundane types of laws about Korban Pesach without really explaining or giving us a reason. But through the chiastic structure, we know there should somewhere here in number 6 be a reason for the Korban Pesach. So just some conclusions we can draw from the structure of our Perek. We eat matzah to recall the Exodus, which is what we said. The Korban Pesach is really unique to those who somehow show adherence to Hashem's laws and covenant, which we'll review more in a second. And Makah B'Chorot is the only one that's contingent on action of Bnei Yisrael. Now, if we go back to our original Rosh Chodesh, which remember was our Kotaret, which was our which was our initial title, I guess, of this whole perek, starts off the perek, we would really say that, again, these laws just reinforce the Ramban's opinion, right? Just like the Ramban is saying, there are intricacies to the laws of Rosh Chodesh, so too, this also seems like a very freedom to type of perek. This is very much about opting in to the laws that Hashem is giving us and really understanding the intricacies and the specificities of these laws, which is very Nachmanidean, very Ramban-esque, still leaving us with some questions about the Sforno. So if everyone is still following me, I'd like to dive just a little deeper into that number six that we were talking about before. And what is it about the intricacies of the laws of Korban Pesach that really explain to us something about the Korban Pesach itself that gives us a why to the Korban Pesach? So again, I highlighted these laws. This is section number six, and I'm highlighting specifically that for some reason, repeated several times or a couple times, is the importance of being circumcised in order to eat the Korban Pesach. And Rav Menachem Liebtag, in his analysis really of this section of the perek, points out that these are not just mundane, everyday type of laws that explain some intricacy about Korban Pesach, but rather they bring us back to a covenant made in Sefer Bereishit. Of course, the covenant I'm talking about is the Brit Milah, meaning in order to partake in the Korban Pesach, we have to, every male who partakes must be circumcised. And it's important to know that because it is, again, this is an opt-in activity, and the Brit Milah is reminiscent of you opting in to being part of the people. It says in Bereshit, Zot briti asher tishmeru b'ni u'b'nechem u'b'n zaracha acharecha himolachem kol zachar. Hashem says to Abraham, this is my brit. This is the covenant between me and you and your offspring for generations. You must have a brit milah. And Rav Liebtag calls this the brit zera. This is the individual brit that we make with Hashem. And what this number six is telling us is that, yes, the reason for the Korban Pesach is in some way a fulfillment of this brit that Hashem gave so long ago, specifically the brit milah. Kol arel lo yochal bo, you cannot partake in this unless you are circumcised. Of course, this brit also reminds us of the only other brit that Hashem makes specifically with Abraham, specifically the brit of Yetziat Mitzrayim, which we got in through the brit ben Havtarim, when Hashem told Abraham to walk between animals, between sets of animals, cut up animals, and at the end, he says, Yadoa teda ki geri yezer acha be'eretz lo lahem, ba'abdum v'inua tamar ba'me'ot shana, that Hashem says to Abraham, your ancestors are going to be slaves in a foreign land, and after that, I am going to let them free, v'acharechen yetzu b'rechush gadol, and then I will bring you into Eretz Yisrael. And I brought the part about the brit here. It says in Bereishit Perek Tevav, Bayam Hahu Karat Hashem et Abraham Brit Lemor, Lizaracha Natati et Haaretz Hazot, Minar Mitzrayim Ad Nahar Gadol Nahar Prat. So this was the brit that Hashem made with Abraham. Rav Liebtag describes this as the brit ha'am, the general, the brit, the national brit, not the individual brit, but the national brit. And so through this understanding, we understand that number six really is explaining to us the why of Korban Pesach. It brings us back to these two britot, these two covenants that Hashem made with Abraham, meaning that the laws of Korban Pesach and the laws of Yetziat Mitzrayim that we learn in Perek Yud Bet in our Parsha should not be understood as standalone, like a standalone segment or standalone laws, but they must be understood within the broader context of our national history. This is the fulfillment of a 400-year-old promise that Hashem made with Avraham all the way back in Sefer Bereshit. And that really helps us understand that chiasm, why it is that Hashem starts off the Perek and then ends off the Perek both with the laws of Korban Pesach to really bring us back in time to this, these britot that Hashem made with Avraham, and to give us more of a national reason of why we are keeping on this continuity in our history. And so just to bring it back, that kind of explained that number six to you. Now, again, we're still stuck on our Rosh Chodesh, and the Ramban really is still kind of coming out as the winner in our understanding of these laws as they relate to Rosh Chodesh. But as I was thinking of this chiasm and this explanation that we really need to understand the laws of Rosh Chodesh or the laws of Korban Pesach within this broader context of Jewish history, I also remembered that the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh by many, many famous parshanim is not really just to be understood alone within the context only of Sefer Shmot, but it's also supposed to be thought of within a broader, really global or creation context. And of course, I'm talking about the very first pasuk in Sefer Bereshit, Bereshit Aleph Aleph, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz, that Hashem created the world. And the very famous first Rashi in the entire Torah, Rashi brings down a midrash, and he says, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak said, the Torah should have started with HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem. The Torah should have started off with the verse HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, and then he gives an explanation through the midrash of why we need Sefer Bereshit at all. But Rashi really reminded me of the importance of looking at HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem as really a, within the context of really the global creation, that according to Rashi, there's this idea that the Torah could have really started off with HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem. Now, interestingly, with this mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh, but for other reasons, we needed Sefer Bereshit. Interestingly, the Ramban, Nachmanides, kind of comes back at Rashi, partially agrees with Rashi, but then actually thinks we could have started the Torah with the Ten Commandments, which is a very different understanding. But what's important here is that Rashi is reminding us that in the 11th century, right, Rashi is really reminding us that this HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, like the mitzvot of Korban Pesach, need to be understood within the broader context of Jewish history. HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem needs to be understood within the broader context of humanity. And I found a beautiful shir by Rav Moshe Stav, who is a Magid Shir, a Ram at Yeshiva KBY Karen Biavna, which is my husband's, I guess, alma mater or yeshiva. So he was very excited when I found this. And he says beautifully, he says, Rabbi Yitzchak's question, so he's talking about this Rashi that we were just talking about, the very first Rashi of the Torah. Rabbi Yitzchak's question is rooted in the assumption that the purpose of the Torah is to teach us mitzvot. The answer to this question is that the stories recorded in Sefer Bereshit teach us the very foundations of our beliefs and an understanding of how Hashem runs the world, which must precede the learning of the mitzvot. And he goes on with, I skipped a little, but he goes on to say, there are two systems of Hashem's providence in the world. The first utilizes the laws of nature and is expressed by the name Elohim, and we'll explore that briefly in a second. The second is overt providence, as reflected in the creation of Klal Yisrael, who live in accordance with the Torah, who are governed directly by Hashem, and who achieve spiritual perfection. In order to create this ideal reality, all the details of the whole, must be perfect, including the sanctity of place, Eretz Yisrael, which lacks nothing, and the sanctity of time, specifically Rosh Chodesh. In order to create such a nation, the prerequisite is that the nation establish its schedule on its own, according to its own priorities. This is the deeper meaning of Sforno's brief comment. So says Rav Stav, he brings up a beautiful idea that he is reminded that Sefer Bereshit really talks about two different systems of Hashem's providence in the world. And I'm reminded through Rav Stav's explanation, I'm very much reminded of the idea of two different forms of creation that we learn about at the very beginning of Sefer Bereshit. Bereshit, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. Some people remember this as Adam 1 and Adam 2 through Rav Soloveitchik. But really that Perek Aleph and Perek Bet of Sefer Bereshit give us very different perspectives on creation. The first, which I have here for you, hopefully that's on the right, is Bereshit Aleph. Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. This Bereshit, this form of Bereshit and Perek Aleph is, as Rav Stav pointed out, an Elohim type of creation, meaning it's very natural, it's very ordered and orderly. The Elohim is often thought of as Midat Hadin, so it has a justice component to it as well. And we know this Perek well through its very clear and orderly division of the days of the week, right? Vayhi erev, vayhi boker, yom echad. There's a very clear cadence, a very clear pattern that follows through the parak. And that really is thought of as Genesis 1, this natural form of creation that is really centered around the nature and the creation of the different components of the natural world. Bereshit 2, Genesis 2, Ela toldot shamayim va'aretz behibaram, b'yom asot Hashem Elokim eretz v'shamayim. So right away we see that a different name of God is used, Hashem Elokim. And the beginning of Perek Bet really is all about the creation of man. It's completely people-centered. Kol siach hasadeh terem yeh ba'aretz, kol esav hasadeh terem yitzmach, nothing had sprouted, nothing was really created yet, because why? There were no human beings to work the land. Sorry, did someone say something? There were no human beings to work the land. And so this parak is really about seeing creation as human-centered, from the perspective of Hashem Elohim, not just Elohim. And the first thing that really happens in the parak is Vayitzar Hashem Elohim et Ha'adam, Afarmin Ha'adama, the creation of Adam, the creation of humans. And so Perek Bet is really thought of as a parak that's about creation of humans so that they can then put their own creative spin and creativity on the world. So it gives humanity, it gives humans more of a more autonomy over their over earth, over creation. And those are two very different aspects of creation. What's fascinating really is that in last week's parsha, Parsha Va'era, is that at the very beginning of the parsha in Perek Vav, Hashem, it says, Va'era el Avraham el Yitzchak ve'el Yaakov. Hashem is talking to Moshe. He says, I showed myself to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov be'el Shaddai, through this name El Shaddai, but Ushmi Hashem lo nodati lahem. But I did not reveal myself through the name of Hashem. The Sforno comments there too and says that it's interesting. What does it mean, Ushmi Hashem lo nodati lahem? It means that Hashem has been governing the world up until now through the Elohim, through Bereshit 1, the natural, the nature way of things. But he had never revealed himself through Bereshit 2, through the Ushmi Hashem. And Rav Stav continues, he says, Chazal debate whether the future redemption will take place in Tishrei or in Nisan. These two views parallel the two different modes of Hashem's Hashgacha. Sefer Bereshit is the Sefer of Elohim, the book of creation and nature, of the power of his actions he recounted to his nation, Koach Ma'asav Higid La'amo, of the Avot who lived their lives guided by Hashem's hand, but in nature. I appear to the Avot with the name Kel Shaddai, but the name Hashem, Yudkei Vavkei, I did not reveal to them. Sefer Shmot, in contrast, is the Sefer of the name of Hashem, the revelation of his Hashgacha, the main goal of which was the creation of his nation. And so, through this interpretation, maybe we can understand a little bit of a different understanding of what the Sforno is really saying. It's possible, at least this is according to Rav Stav's drash and understanding of the Sforno, that the Sforno is not just opening up to a freedom from, you are free to do with whatever you want, but he's evoking a larger idea of what freedom is and what freedom means. We are now charged with this idea, with this charge, really, as B'nai Yisrael, of creativity, of creation, of Hashem, of that Genesis 2. And so if we reread Sforno like that, where it really is, Mikan va'elach yu ha'chodashim shalachem, now you are really charged with this idea of creativity, of creating a nation, of the second coming of the creation, almost, where the beginning of Bereshit was the first, and here in the middle of Shmot, we get a new opportunity of creation, la'asot bahem kirtzonchem, and you have to decide and figure out how to be creative, and how to creatively create your nation. And I think that's a larger idea.
You need to mute everyone. You need to mute everybody because there's a lot of noise.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. So I'll just repeat. So I think it's possible that what Sforno's really doing here in a beautiful way is he is bringing this question of HaChodesh HaZalachem to a larger perspective, to a much more global understanding of what HaFarash HaZalachem really is, which is that you are now charged with this creativity, with this charge of a new creation in this new era of Ushmi Hashem, through Hashem. And you are now able to not just live in a world governed only by Elohim, governed only by nature, but it's your choice to figure out how to best govern this world, or create really this new nation. It reminds me very much of this concept. Rabbi Sacks really talks a lot about freedom in many of his talks and in many of his Divrei Torah, Alav HaShalom, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, of when he talks about freedom. And he says, I brought this quote, he says, that is the freedom that comes from voluntary acceptance of law. That is the kind of freedom that hard work, though it is absolutely invulnerable. It will never die and it will never be conquered. That is the kind of freedom to which we are called as Jews and which we recall ourselves every Pesach. Let us use that freedom first to say I'm proud and tall as Jews, and second, to work for the freedom and justice of all. So he's explaining that opting in and choosing deliberately this creativity and this type of freedom is what really will make us invulnerable. And perhaps that is the type of freedom that the Sforno is referring to. And maybe we were thinking too small when we jumped on the Sforno initially as a freedom from type of commentary. It's possible that the Sforno and the Ramban are not really that different after all, but they're really understanding Rosh Chodesh in maybe a different way, where the Ramban is really seeing it as this is a very law and rule-based mitzvah, and that is the pshat of the psukim, whereas the Sforno brings it to a more global level of us really arming ourselves and taking this charge of Bereshit Bara, but for human beings, HaChodesh HaZalachem. So that's all I have for you for today. So I'm going to stop sharing. And I'm happy to kind of to look at the questions on the side. And if anyone has questions they'd like to ask, if they'd like to turn on their microphone, that's great. But let me start from the beginning, because some of these were lengthier. So Ben Malach says, is there a problem regarding Lidor or Ot Lachem? Is it forever? Or is it just for this generation? Sorry, Ben, were you talking about...
It doesn't use the words Lidor or Techem. And we're very inconsistent when we apply it. Is this, you know, when we hear Lidor or Techem, it means forever. But when it's absent... We don't say it was only a one-time thing. Sometimes yes, and sometimes no.
Right.
We're very inconsistent that way. So I want to know whether this is only for them at that point. Same thing. I never thought of doing announcing the new moon outside of Eretz Yisrael, but this seems to allow for it. Yes, there are problems that having all the people in various lands celebrating the same day for Rosh Chodesh and the Chagim, but at least in theory, could they in Babylon have proclaimed the new month based on the fact that the first one was done in Egypt? So those are two different questions.
Beautiful question. So that really is brought down in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, that they kind of centralized the idea of Rosh Chodesh to only be through, as you know, the Sanhedrin had to be doing Rosh Chodesh, which is eventually why we then keep 2 days of Yom Tov, and there's this whole complication about that. So, but what you're saying is you're reading this Rosh Chodesh as happening outside of Eretz Yisrael, outside of Yerushalayim, which the original law seems really was. But the halacha, when we get to the Gemara, would...
There are practicalities.
Pardon?
There are practicalities.
Exactly.
But,
yes.
But then the other question...
Practicalities. One can ask this whole freedom to be creative on Shabbat and Chagim. Who has this freedom? The men or the women who are busy with all the preparations because they're permitted. So it's an interesting question. You know, I'll leave it at that. Your smile is enough to say you understood what I was asking.
Good comment. I like that. Sorry, Ben, what were you going to say? I'm not sure. All right, we'll go.
I was just going to say that.
Go ahead.
And if this is for generations, even in Eretz Yisrael, how could they switch from a visual to a preordained calendar, if this is what's asked, you know, like what gave them the authority to change it to astronomical calendars as opposed to visual?
Beautiful. So, how did we have the authority to move away from the monthly HaChodesh HaZelachem?
Something that's explicitly said, as opposed to that the details aren't there, but here the details are there.
Beautiful, beautiful. That's a great question. And that really does get to the intricacies of when we moved from, I guess, a nation of ritual that was centered around Jerusalem and that was centered around the Beit HaMikdash to a nation of the book, a people of the book, right? A nation of that was really centered around our oral and written texts, which really did save us as a nation. But it really happens because of emergency circumstances, meaning through following the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, when there was a realization that a Jewish community would have, in order for Judaism to survive, we would have to be able to support a robust Jewish community in Galut outside of Eretz Yisrael, which would therefore lose much of the structure through which we were originally tied. Many, many laws had to kind of be reinterpreted or redone because of that. And it's thought of as being because of an emergency circumstance. So it's a great point, but many will say that is ultimately what saved us, because if we didn't have this calendar that we now adhere to that was written down, it's possible that the months and therefore the Chagim would have been lost forever. But it's a great point. Let's go to Gershon.
He says the freedom on the calendar.
Pardon?
The proclamation of the new month is right now a very, very hot topic in Islam.
Really?
Because people who are living in Christian societies, which is a lot of Muslims, have to know a month in advance when their fasting is going to start.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a matter of a lot of debate. And the debates, as I follow them, are almost identical to the debates that we had about 1,100, 1,200 years ago.
Beautiful. I had no idea. Thank you, Eric. That's fascinating. I did not realize that was a matter of debate currently. That's really interesting. I don't want to lose Gershon's comment. He says the freedom of Jews is symbolized by the fact that they control time, which is based on a lunar calendar. This link may be why the Midrash states that the moon itself was fighting for the equality with the sun, right? That's a famous, the very famous Midrash of the sun and the moon, the creation of the sun and the moon in Perek Aleph. The moon achieved freedom from the sun, just as the Israelites achieved it from the Egyptians. Fascinating. What an interesting idea and a nice comment. I think somebody else wrote something about the sun and the moon as well in reference to Hashem and Elohim. Since the mitzvah seems to have been performed in Egypt, why couldn't we learn that this could be performed locally? At least
we discussed.
Oh, that's what you said. Beautiful, beautiful. Okay. The four freedoms, the FDRs, Eric, you wrote that. What about a female stranger? How can she eat the Korban Pesach? That's a great point. I'm not sure who said that. An anonymous comment. Well, I mean, that's a great point. That really is the question of the Brit Zera in general and about the Brit Milah. We think of it as it's an individual Brit incumbent on every male, but where's the equivalent of the female? I've thought about this before many times and discussed this in many classes and groups. I haven't come up with a good answer to this question. Presumably, though, a female Gioret would be able to participate in the eating of the Korban Pesach just by virtue of her wanting to participate. Again, this is an opt-in kind of mitzvah. And so she doesn't have to do anything physical because there's nothing physical. There's no physical mitzvah that she could do. But by virtue of her wanting to be there, she should be able to be a participant the same way as a circumcised ger. So it's a great question. I don't have a great answer. And if anyone does, please send me any article or anything you've heard about it. The ancient East was divided into two classes, those who were circumcised and those who didn't. That's very interesting, Eric. Who is charged with the creativity? Everyone. Ben, you talked about that too. And Gershon re-comments. He says, you explained why God diminished the sun to make it the moon. This diminution allows Hashem a major role replacing or superseding Elohim. I don't fully understand if Gershon is still here. I'm happy to talk to him about that comment. But
what I'm saying is that,
yeah,
that Hashem enters the scene only by virtue of the fact that he delegates to us the making of the calendar. And he moves away from the role of Elohim.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Hashem. I love that. That is a beautiful idea. I think that's true.
It was only possible because the second son stormed the Bastille.
Stormed the what?
The Bastille.
Oh, interesting. I think that's a very nice kind of analogy of this movement from Elohim to Hashem. And we see this come up many, many times. I have less to comment on the sun. I think that's a fascinating idea, but that we see Hashem coming in really as the banner or the main force of godliness through which we really serve Hashem, especially in the 13 midot, the Shlosh Esrei midot of Rachamim, that we, after Chet Ha'egel, which are Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum Hachanun, again, we evoke the Yud Kei Vav Kei in these moments of really trying to evoke this very strong connection to Hashem. So there, it seems that after this Exodus, after HaChodesh HaZelachem, there's a more of a movement towards the Hashem. It's not perfect. It's not like you can go through the whole Tanakh and see exactly when Hashem is used versus when Elohim was used, the creative versus the nature, or the Midat HaDin versus the Midat HaRachamim. But in many cases, it is an interesting analysis.
Well, it's interesting. We rewrite the Shlosh Esrei Midrot. We change Nake, Lo Yonake.
Yes, yes.
We don't use the Peshat.
We don't use the Peshat, yes. But we have precedent because Yonah doesn't, and neither does Eliyahu. So, you know.
Yeah.
But fair enough. All right. If there are no more questions.
Can I ask a side question?
Shelley, please do.
The side question is, when it starts out in verse 1, God speaks to Moshe and Aaron. We know that God speaks to Moshe face to face. How is he speaking to Aaron? Aaron isn't quite on that level. Do they fall asleep? How does this work?
That's a great question. We don't know 100% that Hashem spoke to Moshe peh el peh or panim el panim every single time. But we also notice that the way God talks to Moshe changes throughout his life, seemingly as Moshe kind of rises in spiritual status, right? So the way that Hashem speaks to Moshe before Har Sinai is different from the way that Hashem speaks to Moshe after Har Sinai. So we notice these changes, and we learn at the end of Moshe's life, and of course during the sin of Miriam and Aaron with Tzara'ad, that Hashem really does speak to Moshe differently. But I think early on, in those early moments, we notice that Hashem speaks frequently to Moshe and Aharon together. And I would imagine that he's speaking to them in a very similar way and through a similar conduit. So I do think it changes. There's a greater differentiation as the Moshe story kind of progresses and as we see Moshe progress to higher levels of Nevuah. If that's helpful at all, right?
You don't know if they're awake or not.
I don't know. Really, there are only a few times in the Tanakh where we really understand the level of consciousness. One of them being in the brief Ben Haftarim that we talked about with Avraham, where it says that a tardema came on Avraham, that Avraham was in a trance. And we understand through that he sees Hashem in a state that's semi-conscious, right? So that becomes more clear of how the Nevuah was given. But we don't often understand the state of consciousness. Another maybe is Shmuel, where he hears Hashem more in a sleep state and he wakes up thinking that it was really Eli who was calling to him. So that's another time where we know kind of the level of consciousness of a Navi, but we're not generally privy to that information. It's a great point.
Thank you.
For sure. Any other questions from anyone?
Well, to go back to the creativity, because it was Mr. Mendelssohn also commented on it.
Mm-hmm.
You smiled. I prefer words.
Okay, so, well, go ahead.
Your comment on it. Doesn't creativity also come in conflict with Ask Your Rebbe and the whole hierarchical system? So I love creativity,
mm-hmm.
but I think we all have the ability to use it, but
mm-hmm.
it's not the rabbinic system. Only the mm-hmm. rabbis want to be mm-hmm. creative, and only at certain points.
Beautiful. So that is true. And that really does speak to, I guess, when we hear about in Sefer Dvarim, like in Parshat Re'eh and those Parshiyot, when we understand that Hashem says, I've given you two roads, right? Re'eh natati lefanecha et hachayim et hatov, et hamavet et harau, bacharta bachayim. Meaning that you have a choice to make either the right choice or the wrong choice, and I want you to choose life. Which we understand through these, I guess, the literary consistencies between these prakim and Dvarim and actually the creation story to mean that Chaim really means listening to the word of Hashem in whatever way that is. So I think that Sforno would probably go more with that idea, that the choice and the freedom of creativity is how we are setting up our nation and how we are choosing to follow the Torah and setting up the Torah as a people. But in terms of like individual creativity, am I allowed to be my
own? But even what you even what you said just now about how you set up, that was that generation. We're born into a particular system.
Yes.
Which we, you know, and this is a philosophy in general about any society.
Totally.
You're born into it. How much can you change it? How much can you, you know, or do you have to go outside of it to change it, all that? But there's no creativity for us today that way.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I don't know. I think as a nation today, we still are seeing some fascinating developments in creativity still, I would argue, within the confines very much of rabbinic law and rabbinic halakha. So something like a yoetzet, the movement of yoetzot halakha, or the movement of a halakhic prenuptial agreement. Those things were not in existence ever, right, in rabbinic Judaism, but they came about through the needs of the time. And we were creative, we were able to be creative within, with still within rabbinic Judaism, but to kind of fit in. Now, there are those who would disagree and say, you know, those things are complete apikorsut and we're not within those confines. But I do think that there is still room. We are still seeing growth and room for creativity and movement, even within the structure, I guess, of rabbinic Judaism. But I agree with you, Ben. It's a much, it's a philosophical conversation.
They tried to put a lock on it by saying everything earlier is better and everything today is no good. And we have to fight against that. We didn't, that's not what it should be. That was a way of silencing future generations. And we as Jews won't be silenced.
Interesting, right? And remember, so, right, there is this tendency of what was before is better.
Remember that Miriam overcame the god El Hador.
Say that again, Miriam.
Overcame the ruling of the god El Hador.
Beautiful. Absolutely. Yes. Even in those times, there was, there were those who stood up, maybe
and that said, and that said in the Midrash. That's not my Kiddush. The Midrash points that out. How did
About Miriam.
About Miriam.
Beautiful. I mean, it's an important and interesting philosophical conversation, Ben, but I do think that, and Eric and Gershom, but I do think that one would and could argue that there is still, there remains room.
There is creativity, but Judaism, as we know it, as you said, that it was recreated or after the temple, Second Temple was destroyed. But it was when Judaism was a minority and in other cultures, so they stepped a certain way. One of the possible negatives of having the majority of Jews in Israel with everything centralized is this tendency to dictate rather than persuade. You're in Atlanta, you're trying to persuade people of your viewpoint. In Israel, they have martial law, they have the police force and the budget. They no longer try and persuade as much, they try and just dictate, which creates a different kind of Judaism. And it's one of the possible negatives.
Yeah, there's definitely, as now we've shifted toward a majority of the Jewish people are living in Israel, we're getting back to different, like you're pointing out, there are very different challenges from being a minority in where you live. Absolutely. And we do see this kind of schism that's emerging between what are the challenges that we in the Gola, that we in the Galut grapple with versus the Jewish communities in Israel, which are very, very different. So I do agree. Anyway, we are up on the hour, so I'm going to end this for now. Anyone is free to contact me, or I'm happy to continue this discussion another time. But Shabbat Shalom to everybody, and have a wonderful Shabbat.
Thank you, Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you for your time.
What is your email address?
I will put it in the chat. Thank you.
Thank you.
You are welcome to email.
Thank you.